You'll see, I work at the church history department, as JB mentioned, and they ask us to just let you know that if you want to be on the mailing list for cutting-edge publications or other exciting news from the Church Historians Press, and those come out maybe 3 times a year, these emails, it's not spam, we're passing around a paper so you can sign your email on that. And if the person next to you doesn't sign up for that list, it's not because it's not cool, it's because they're already on the list. They're already part of the cool faction. I wanted to start with just a note about method. I'm speaking today as a historian, unlike the people who spoke before me, strictly speaking. The way a historian approaches a talk on grace in Mormonism should be a little different than how a philosopher or a theologian or a literature professor would do it. Historians feel a particular responsibility to the fact of change over time. So when we talk about ideas, we are beholden to root those ideas in a particular place and a particular time. So I'm not going to speak today about what grace means to me, what grace meant to our founder, or what I wish you all thought, how I wish you all understood grace. I'm going to speak specifically about how LDS women appeared to understand grace in the 1980s. And I'll start with just a couple of snapshots to illustrate this change over time moment from the 19th century. I did a quick survey of women's words about grace throughout church history, and most of them are around the 19th century. Here's Eliza R. Snow in 1869. "My prayer is that we may have grace to overcome evil with good." So she's speaking about grace as a power, a spiritual power. "Have power to withstand every temptation." She said that at a Relief Society meeting. Or here, a few years later, is Elvira Barney. And this was at a meeting of the National Suffrage Association that was meeting in Salt Lake City. She said, "We pray that thou wilt, in thine own way and time," this was a prayer, "mellow the hearts of the wicked and immoral, that thy grace may spread and form a canopy over the whole earth." So this vision of grace sounds to me like a protection, like a protective canopy, divinely sourced. And then finally, Bathsheba Smith in 1906, and her vision of grace. She says, "Faith, hope, and charity are necessary for divine grace," and her use of grace in a larger context is about salvation, and it's also, she's using it in some of the ways I heard echoes in some of the passages that Sam was sharing with us from 19th century Latter-day Saints and from earlier scripture. A few months ago, Terrell Givens visited the Church History Library, and to be provocative, as you know he sometimes is, he made this offhand comment about how Latter-day Saints maybe don't even believe in grace. And if you heard his talk this morning, you know he didn't mean that strictly speaking, but I just wanted to rise up and say, yes, we do. And I immediately thought of a story that Jeanette Hales Beckham had told me. She was one of the young women general presidents. And after that, she was a primary teacher. And she had a little girl in her class that one day, she was a 10-year-old, said, "I don't think I'm going to make it." And when Sister Hales asked her, a little Sister Beckham asked her a few more questions, the little girl meant she didn't think she was going to make it to heaven. She didn't think she could be good enough. And so the next week, they talked about the atonement. And Sister Beckham said, "We are worthy because of his righteousness, not our own." And to me, that's a contemporary, this was after the year 2000, that's a contemporary perspective on grace that resonates with Latter-day Saint tradition, but really focuses on the aspect of grace that it's not something we earn. It's something beyond us that transforms us. So Terrell said this, I thought of that example. Then this invitation to speak came my way, and I thought, I'm going to show how Mormons believe in grace. And then I looked, and I didn't find Mormon women speaking much about grace. And I thought, oh no, what if Terrell's right? So So I want to look at the 1980s with you today. And one of the reasons I want to look at the 1980s is because they came right after the period of correlation, and because they came when a lot was going on in society that was challenging and divisive to women. Now, women and men in the same church are going to have a lot of overlap in the way they understand a theological principle. And of course, that's true of grace. So to think about why I would speak only about women, the answer to that question is because some of women's experiences affected them particularly because they were women. For example, all of the debate that was still raging in the 1980s about what and where women would contribute to society and the broader world. And you see, I have two images here. I put John Stamos there just because I didn't want Ronald Reagan to be the only man. But we have women who are pro-ERA, and we have Phyllis Schlafly here, who Barbara Smith said, while she was Relief Society General President, she later said, it was Phyllis Schlafly who convinced me I needed to speak openly against the ERA, and I needed to encourage male church leaders to also speak openly against the ERA. So these questions raging outside of the church in the United States and also inside of the church that really were specific to women's experience and how women understood their own potential contributions. So what happens in the general church in the 1980s around conversations of grace? We have the Bible Dictionary comes out in 1981, and I don't think we can underestimate how those definitions in the Bible Dictionary have influenced the way everyday Latter-day Saints and scholars have understood Mormon approaches to grace. We also have a speech by Ezra Taft Benson. It was his Christmas speech in 1988. I think I have a slide here. Here we go. Where he quoted, as does the Bible Dictionary, 2 Nephi 25:23, it is by grace that we are saved, after all we can do. And Ezra Taft Benson structured his speech around that. And then he defined all we can do. He said, all we can do means living the commandments, loving our fellow men, praying for our adversaries, giving succor, being chaste, being honest. And I even condensed his list. And if you imagine that all you can do includes all of those things and perfect performance of all of those things, that's a lot to take on. It's a good thing that there's grace coming in to help balance that equation. Then the last year of the 80s, 1989, we have Bruce Hafen's crucial book that is shaped, along with Robinson's book, the way everyday Latter-day Saints understand grace and the role of grace in their lives, The Broken Heart, Applying the Atonement to Life's Experiences. So Benson's talk, so we have Bible Dictionary in 81, available to everybody who bought a new version of the scriptures. We have Benson's talk towards the end of the 80s, and then we have the Broken Heart in 89 that are shaping the way Mormons are thinking about grace, and they really weren't talking very much about grace. So then I looked, my wonderful research assistant who's here, Jessica Nelson, helped me look. We looked through general conference talks by women in the 80s, didn't find mention of grace. We looked through speeches given at BYU, devotionals, didn't find mention of grace. We looked through BYU Women's Conference addresses, and we found a little bit. And that little bit is what I'll focus on today. Part of why I chose to speak about the 80s is because it seemed like a decade when women, Mormon women, and men were particularly in need of grace. Grace because of the divisiveness and all that was going on in society. And also because this woman in the middle here, Ardeth Kapp, I just can't stop thinking about her and writing about her and speaking about her. She became the Young Woman General President in 1984, but that is not the beginning of her history with young women. The beginning of her history with the Young Women Program was in the 60s when Harold B. Lee established an all-church coordinating committee. We often, when we talk about correlation, this is what we mean. He established the all-church coordinating committee, and he asked her to be on this committee, on the youth division of this committee. So she would read all of the materials that had been produced for youth, and she would read all of the materials that were being produced in the future to be distributed to young people. And she cared, she was really on board with the need to simplify and correlate church materials. At the same time, she was living through the institutional changes of correlation that had a real impact on women in the church. So she was on this committee, and then in the early 70s, when Florence Jacobson was no longer Young Women president, Ruth Funk was put in as Young Women president. Ardith Kapp was Ruth Funk's counselor. And then after her tenure in that presidency, she became a management consultant for a few years while Elaine Cannon was president. And then she became president. So really understanding and supporting a lot of the attributes of correlation, living through and thinking about the results of what was going on in American culture for young people, especially young women, she became the president. And let's talk a little bit about these institutional changes. That impacted the Young Women Program because of correlation. So correlation resulted in a complete overhaul of the organization's hallmark personal achievement programs. One example of this is the Beehive Program. It started in 1915, and it lasted until 1970. And every woman raised in the church went through the Beehive Program and would complete tasks and sew them on, a band that went around her. It was really a crucial, and they would choose, along with the Beehive Program, they would choose a symbol like an animal. I have an example in my office of somebody who chose a squirrel, and they made a little felt squirrel and sewed it on to their band, or a flower, or something that would inspire them and help them figure out who they were and how they would be contributing to the church as they became adults. Gone. No more Beehive Program. It was also marked the end of close collaboration with the Young Men Organization, which collaboration had existed since before the turn of the last century. So for almost 100 years, young men and young women leaders met and They would take turns even conducting their meetings at the general level, and they made all of their plans together, and they helped each other to execute their plans, and especially the women helped to execute the plans because most of the time they weren't working other than their role in the Young Women Organization, and most of the time the men involved in the Young Men Organization had jobs, and so the women had a little more time or a lot more time to contribute to the organization than they did. They had a June conference where everybody would come for training and for help understanding the goals and the programs of these youth programs for young men and young women. Gone, this conference that meant so much to so many people. And finally, there was a complete rerouting of training and communication systems, which meant that people who were used to going once a year to this conference, or a local young woman leader who was used to getting letters from the general young woman president, no longer received the information in that way. So there was a breakdown as people adjusted to the new communication systems. There was a breakdown in communication, and a lot of times messages did not get conveyed to leaders on the local level. There had been changes, massive changes. Let's have this be our personal achievement program. No, that's not working. Let's have this be our personal achievement program. Let's have this be our name. For a while, the Young Women program was called the Aaronic Priesthood Young Women. And then they decided when Spencer Kimball became prophet, that's not working. Let's go back. Let's call it the Young Women Program. And sometimes you would call it MIA, the Mutual Improvement Association. Other times, no, we need young women and young men to develop their own spiritual identities separate from each other. We're not going to have MIA anymore. So just a lot of changes and a lot of problems in conveying those changes in a way that Latter-day Saints could understand them. So one point of this is that when Ardith Kapp became president, people said to her, don't make any more changes. Like, what we really need here is stability. And the challenge for her was that she felt from the moment she was called, revelation pouring down about some changes she needed to make in the young women's program. She felt it pouring down to the extent that she had to keep three different notebooks to help her manage it all. There was the revelation that came while she was reading her scriptures. There was the revelation that came during meetings. There was the revelation that came during prayer or times of contemplation. So she feels this mandate directly from heaven to make some changes. And because of the all of the changes in hierarchy, if it had been 30 years earlier, she could have gone directly to the first presidency and said, this is what I'm feeling, this is what I think we can do, and it would have gone on. But she did not have access to the decision makers at this period. So it was a tricky situation for her to be in. I want to tell you some of the details of the revelation that she felt after going through, meeting with her counselors, meeting with her board, praying, reading her scriptures, things that she really felt needed to happen to the Young Women program. She said, I feel, and she felt this early on, I feel the need that we must have a charter, a statement for young women as strong as the mission statement for young men, as outlined in the Doctrine and Covenants. Something that we can focus on, verbalize, plan for, with a value-prioritized goal. Do you know what this statement would become then? The young women theme, is that what you're... Yeah, the young women theme. She also knew that she was looking for guiding principles, and those would become the young women values. She wanted to have values be the measuring stick instead of areas of focus, and that came from her time as a management consultant. So we end up with the young women theme. We end up with the young women values. But how did we get those approved in light of all of the resistance people had institutionally to change? And in light of the limitations on how she could share her voice? Let's see. Kapp remembers, she was reflecting back in 1992, that some of the difficulties in her getting these changes through included that the general authorities to whom she reported frequently changed assignment. So, and the number of steps that you had to have approved to get something finally done so you could take action on it would also change. So if there were 23 things that you had to do to get a new program approved, she could be on number 20. And then they could revise what the steps of approval were, and she'd have to start back at number one. Or her general authority advisor would change, and the new person, completely understandably, and she thinks it's completely understandable, wouldn't want to just approve something that he knew nothing about, but she'd have to start at the beginning, educating him, helping him to understand where she was going, which approvals she'd achieved, what the vision of this was, help him feel that it was inspired as she felt it was inspired. So there were some real obstacles. And this is her lived experience of grace that I'm tracing here. Finally, let's see. I want to tell about two moments where she has a lived experience of grace. One of them is that finally they are invited to present their ideas about what would become the values and the theme and a cutting-edge satellite broadcast of a fireside to educate everybody about the values and the theme. They have the chance to bring these before the Priesthood Executive Committee, and that was the decision-making body. And so they... Okay, one more story I'm going to throw in here. In preparation for this, she knew that she had to educate people about what they were trying to get approval for before the actual meeting. This is something when I started my job at the Church History Department, the director, Reed Nielsen, gave me some good advice, and some of it was, he called it the meeting before the meeting. you have to familiarize people with what you're proposing before you get to the meeting where they're going to vote yes or no, or else you have a much greater chance of it being voted down just because they don't want to make a bad decision and they don't want to be caught off guard. So CAP intuitively understood this meeting before the meeting approach. And when she would see, she bought this really fancy piece of equipment. It predated a VCR, but was sort of like that. But it would help you project images and show charts. And so when she would meet somebody in the cafeteria, one of the general authorities who would be part of that decision-making board, she would say, oh, you should come look at this really interesting piece of equipment that we have that helps with presentations. And that was exciting to them. So they would come over and she would demonstrate the equipment. But as she demonstrated the equipment, all of the slides and everything that she had downloaded onto it were about these young women changes that they wanted to make. So by the time she finally went to this meeting, several of the male decision makers there were familiar with it. They knew it because they'd been to see this piece of equipment, and they already had had time to process it and think about it. And then they became, they really supported her and spoke for her ideas at this crucial meeting. Well, after she had found out that they were going to be able to attend this meeting, it was about 6 weeks before she had a revelatory experience. And what I'm trying to set up here is that her lived experience of grace really aligns with the way that we've come to talk about grace in the church, that it's both the all you can do and it's the divine intervention. Because the all she could do was really complicated. It was her 3 notebooks full of revelation. It was meeting after meeting after meeting with her own boards so that collaboratively they could access. Elder Bednar talks about how every person on a council has a piece of inspiration, and what you want to do is bring all of that inspiration together. That's why councils matter. That's the way she conducted her board. So all of this work, including the messages to people in the cafeteria, including them to come over and look at her machine, were leading up to this meeting. That was the all that she could do. But then she also needed grace. There was still so much out of her control. And she woke up. Her appointment was in February 1985. And on January 6th, she woke up early and she started writing as fast as she could in the yellow notebook that she kept by her bed. I'm not sure whether that was the scripture notebook or the prayer notebook or the... She wrote about the needs and problems that she and her board members perceived, about the research data that they'd gathered, and she felt the elements fall into place for her proposal to the Priesthood Executive Council. After she finished just madly taking these notes, she felt that this document that just came to her in the early morning had come after 6 months of careful labor by her general board, but ultimately by revelation. She felt spiritually uplifted, but perspiring with physical and emotional exhaustion. And after she writes the document, she offers a prayer of gratitude. One lived experience of grace. The second lived experience of grace is about the same meeting. Before attending the meeting, she and her presidency members said a prayer. And in their prayer, they said, "If it is right, let the brethren's ears be opened. And if not, if it isn't right, let them be closed, and we will go back and begin again." Carolyn Rasmus was the woman who actually figured out how to operate the complicated equipment in the young women offices. She was CAP's colleague. Her title was secretary. She recorded the results of the PEC meeting in shorthand so we can know really what happened in that meeting, because she took the shorthand while they were there. At the end of the Young Women Presidency's presentation, Ezra Taft Benson, who was an apostle at the time, said, "Brethren, I think we should stand." And Thomas S. Monson, another apostle at the time, said, "We must address this challenge. We must put our attention to this problem." and our now President Nelson, who was Elder Nelson at the time, and this is cute, since he was a physician, he said, we have the diagnosis, now we need the prescription. They also said, you have our strong endorsement of what has been said here. All of this, of course, mattered a lot to the presidency, but the quotation that mattered the most was from Elder Faust, because at the end of their presentation, he said, today you have not only opened our eyes, but also our ears. And to Ardeth Kapp, that felt like the specific evidence of grace, that exactly using the words that she had used in the prayer right before the meeting, that Elder Faust had echoed those words in his response to the presentation. Okay, now we get to talk about Louise Plummer. Do you raise your hand if you've taken a course with Louise Plummer? Oh, gosh, I'm sorry. Her husband taught German here for a long time, and she taught creative writing. And in 1986 or 87, she gave a talk at the BYU Women's Conference called Thoughts of a Grasshopper. And Thoughts of a Grasshopper became so popular that they ended up putting it in a book of essays by her. The essay was there. The book of essays is called Thoughts of a Grasshopper, and it was a bestseller. I think it's still in print. Thoughts of a Grasshopper starts with her analyzing grace, though she doesn't call it grace, in the tale of the ants and the grasshopper. And she tells the Disney version that she had watched when she was a child, where the ant is playing his violin and eating leaves off the trees, and the ants are getting ready for winter. And they keep telling him, you need to get ready for winter. You can't just keep playing around. You need to get ready for winter. And he keeps playing around. And when it's cold, there's a snowstorm, and he comes up and he knocks on the door of the ant's house in the tree. He says, I don't have anything to eat. I'm cold. And the queen of the ants points her finger at him, and she gives him a lecture because he didn't prepare for winter. But then she lets him in. And once he's in, he plays his fiddle. She says to him, you should have prepared, but you didn't. Now come into our lighted, warm room and play your fiddle, and we'll dance. So you see that even that has that we give something, and then there's forgiveness. There's an element of grace, and it works out for us. She also shares Aesop's version, in which there is no grace, in which the grasshopper in the snowstorm knocks on the door, and the queen says, you sang through the summer, now you can dance through the winter. And she closes the door, dance to keep warm. Then Louise Plummer said, this has always made me uncomfortable, these versions of the story. And the reason they make me uncomfortable is because I am a grasshopper. She gives lots of evidence of the ways, the wonderful ways that she is a grasshopper. One of them is that it takes her a full day to dismantle her Christmas tree because she dresses up in the decorations. She wraps the gold tinsel around her head like a turban. She makes a shawl for her neck from glass beads and paper chains. She has a special pair of red high heels that she only wears on the day when she takes down the Christmas tree. She has red glass balls that hang from her ears, and she sings in front of the hall mirror. She sings about New York. If you can make it there, you'll make it anywhere. She says, I don't know who wrote that star, but it's the kind of that song, but it's the kind of song that can make you a star. She says that she does occasionally clean out from under her bed, but then immediately she goes and she writes, makes a list of what she found under the bed. It's a list that takes up 3 pages. She said, I was raised by ants, and I've wondered how I, as a grasshopper, can fit into a family of ants, and she's wondered how she, as a grasshopper, can fit into a church of ants. She says that the first question about her family, her mother often asked as well. She still likes to go to her mother's house, well, when this was given. She likes to open the linen closet and see the impeccably folded items, color-coded lined up. She likes to look at her mother's food storage, go down there and see it's not just food, it's a year's supply, and it has soap and everything that you could need for a full year, and it's dust-free. She says she enjoys that. She certainly doesn't achieve it. Once she decided to can some peaches, and she got 3 jars, and she put them in her freezer, which made me think, of course, that's not canning peaches, that's freezing peaches. I'm a little on the ant grasshopper spectrum, a little more on the ant spectrum. She's not her mother. But then she went once to Holland to visit her father's mother, and she saw that woman, her Oma, set her alarm for 9 a.m. so that she wouldn't sleep past 9, and she understood that's where I came from, in the family. But she's also found a place where she comes from in the church, in this Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And that's what this quote is about. Without the atonement of Jesus Christ, our virtues, whatever they are meaningless. We are all equally human. And I wanted to talk about grace with Louise Plummer because I wanted to explore the way she changes our understanding of grace, of the aspect of all that you can do. And I also wanted to talk about the way she changes the ending to the grasshopper and the ants. This is her changing to the story. It's winter. The grasshopper is wearing her raincoat over a sweater because she can't find a parka because it's under her bed. She's talking out loud to herself and then answering her own questions out loud. She's eating breakfast, and she's out of groceries, so she's eating a brownie, and she's washing it down with milk that she bought from the 7-Eleven. And she doesn't knock on the door to the ants, but the door swings open. And the queen of the ants says, "We are bored to death. Help us." They said, "Our teenagers are driving us crazy in here." And she takes off her raincoat and says, "I can help you." And she writes them a roadshow. And she answers their questions. And she begins to make everybody laugh. And she begins to entertain everybody. And the ant says, "Where do you get these ideas?" And the grasshopper says, "They come to me while I'm taking long, hot baths." And then she explains, what about works? And that's one of the more direct allusions to the grace equation that we get in this talk. What about works? Like, don't ants work harder than grasshoppers? And shouldn't that count for something? And Plummer answers, no. Grasshoppers work differently from ants. She rejects our attempts to really carefully define that equation in ways that narrow our conception of what God and grace can be. This vision of the grasshopper and the ants, it's a vision of grace, it's a vision of the body of Christ where we each have something to contribute, but it's also more radical than that. It's a reason to look to the pews in addition to looking to the pulpit when you as an individual are trying to figure out what grace has meant to people at a certain period, in a certain place, and what it means for you today, now, in your seats here. Thank you.